Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Three segments today. We'll hear from Richard Seymour on the cultural politics of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, from the librarian Emily Drabinsky on the war on libraries, and from Annie Levin on the Cold War style of fiction writing, which is still with us. Russia's invasion of Ukraine has produced an amazing mobilization in what is reflexively and uncritically called the West. It's like a revival of the Cold War, with the anti-communist Putin in the role of communist ogre, accompanied by something of a witch hunt against those who don't immediately join in full-throated denunciation. We're even seeing a revival of an old-style left anti-communism, where any complexity in your analysis is denounced as sympathy with the enemy. What is going on here? To explore that question, we're joined by Richard Seymour, the writer, broadcaster, one of the founding editors of Salvage magazine, and author of The Twittering Machine and The Disenchanted Earth. He has an excellent piece on the New Left Review's sidecar blog called The Belligerati. Richard Seymour. We've got some serious nationalist organization going on around the globe because of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. We're seeing it in Ukraine, but we're also seeing it, of course, in the U.S. and Britain. The Journal of Molecular Structures banning papers from Russian institutions, and McDonald's pulling out of Russia because of its values, whatever those are. What do you think of this this mobilization in sympathy with Ukraine?
Sympathy with Ukraine wouldn't be a bad place to start, depending on what you mean by that. It seems to be, in practice, a kind of parochialized sympathy with people like us. The emphasis of an awful lot of reporting, you know, this is not some third world backward place. This is European civilization. We've heard this before during the Balkan Wars, when you would get a lot of lines like, oh, did you know that Srebrenica is just 2 hours by plane away from Paris? So it's a way of identifying with an idealized version of Ukraine, which means basically with a particular faction in Ukrainian politics led by Volodymyr Zelensky, broadly liberal internationalist, but obviously has a far right contingent that is small but influential. It has very little to do in practice with supporting Ukrainians being brutalized, pulverized by the Russian invasion. I mean, what's happening in Mariupol is heartrending. But, this has very little material impact on that. It's much more, I think, about identity formation. Obviously, the Journal of Molecular Structures banning papers from Russian academic institutions is a kind of comical aside to this. But more seriously, string of multinationals suspending their commercial operations in Russia. And you think Russians not being able to buy Coca-Cola or get a Big Mac is not going to stop people from being murdered in Mariupol or Odessa in the future. Similarly, you know, some supermarkets in the United Kingdom, I know the United States has had similar things. They've been taking Russian vodka off the shelves. This is a rather indiscriminate way of identifying an enemy. People talk about the problem as if it's uniquely Putin, and yet in practice behave as if the problem is Russians and the Russian language and Russian products.
The mobilization here reminds me of the days just after 9/11. But we were attacked directly then. I mean, people in New York. I mean, I was just a couple of miles from the site of the World Trade Center. Yet we're having a very, very similar psychological mobilization. What do you attribute that that parallelism to?
It does feel like a similar kind of rupture in the world system. The parallel, perhaps, is that in both cases, the omnipotence of the United States, which was always imaginary, has been challenged in this case by Russia's ability to intervene in Ukraine and essentially do more or less what it wants, as long as it can bear the costs, obviously, demonstrates hard limits to American power, which had not perhaps been visible before. Because if you were looking at the situation, the global situation circa 2001, the only major challenge to the United States was, non-state groups. Al-Qaeda was the big one, obviously, and then ISIS. Russia under Putin was very supportive of the war on terror. Russia under Putin wanted to join NATO. This is often forgotten. Putin's not against NATO. He's against Russia being marginalized in that context, which tells us something about what Putin is. There is a similar sense that the world system is being shaken up and reconfigured. Now, I think actually what's taking place is quite the reverse of 9/11 in some ways, because you know, what we saw with 9/11 was that the United States was drawn into multiple conflicts by a combination of the provocation of the far-right jihadists and the sort of neoconservative right and the adventurist right in the United States. And that weakened the United States quite substantially in the global situation relative to unparalleled global dominance that it had been enjoying throughout the 1990s. Whereas at the moment, what's happening is that Russia is destroying its potential for at least enjoying a kind of regional hegemony. I think that the idea that Russia is going to enjoy hegemony within Ukraine after this, it might tear up Ukraine. It might tear off a few chunks of Ukraine. It might even be able to occupy Ukraine for an extended period, but it's going to deplete and drain itself. So it's a different situation, but psychologically there seems to be a similar sense of rupture within a world system and a realignment of sensibilities, because let's face it, almost nobody in the world is in favor of what Russia is doing in Ukraine. And given that the United States is not rushing headlong into war, quite sensibly, I might say, there's very little sort of occasion for a kind of left-wing mobilizing or rallying point. The rallying is really being done, I think, by the political center, you know, and a lot of this is coming from people without much broad popular support, but who have influential voices in the national media and in various other vantage points, pushing the idea of a much more aggressive foreign policy, a moralized foreign policy, a kind of 19th century liberal imperialism almost, to crush Vlad. You know, it's also comes along with this kind of reheated anti-communism, which is extraordinary given
Putin announced the invasion as explicitly anti-Leninist, but yet he's seen by a lot of people in the West as a communist.
It's extraordinary. I mean, this has been building for some time. I remember being in New York a few years back. I was over there for a conference and walking about, and I saw graffiti that portrayed Donald Trump as, you know, a stooge of Putin and had the hammer and sickle and everything. And I'm aware that that kind of portrayal is not uncommon in the United States, that Putin is de facto some sort of Bolshevik, because nobody knows what communism is. Nobody ever has known what communism is, even when it was a real historical force. There was a lot of people who just didn't really understand what communism was about. We know that it's wicked. We know that it's bad. We know that it's something to do with unbridled power, trampling on the little people, etc. Well, Putin has been cast in that way since 2014. And so it's extraordinary because, of course, he did say upon launching his invasion that part of what he would be doing would be decommunization. I mean, this is in reference to your point about his beef with Lenin and the legacy of Leninism, when the Bolsheviks essentially supported a national status for Ukraine to ward off great Russian chauvinism. Now, of course, a lot of that was undone by Stalin, but, you know, Putin obviously is nostalgic for one aspect of the Soviet experience, which was that the centralized Russian state at that time was quite powerful. It commanded global respect, even if it wasn't particularly liked, and was able to project power on a global scale. Putin has been trying to revive aspects of this with his fight with Georgia in 2008, which wasn't started by Russia, but Putin finished it off decisively with the intervention in Crimea, the annexation, and with the intervention in Syria. He would have liked to have done this in a way that was in partnership with the United States and the West, hence his support for the war on terror, hence his coordination with the United States when acting in Syria. But that's not the way it's turned out. So it's interesting how these ideological phantasms from a previous era, in this case the phantasm of communism, have been revived in this context. It's always been the case that the anti-communists have had an utterly fantastical and unrealistic perception of what communism is. This is not new. Donald Trump thinks communism is Black Lives Matter, cultural Marxism, you know, Antifa, whatever it is. It's almost as if it ultimately goes back to the original conspiracy theory, the great satanic conspiracy theory, the witch hunts, you know, that there has to be somebody who bears all the dysfunctions, all the evils, all the ills of the system, everything that goes wrong, it doesn't work, it doesn't add up. And that somebody has historically been the Antichrist or Jewish or Freemason or communist. That should alert us to the reactionary potential, if not actuality, of this discourse about Putin.
I'm speaking with Richard Seymour, author of The Belligerati, on the cultural politics of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, published on the New Left Review's blog, Sidecar. You say in your piece that we're provincializing sympathy with Ukrainians, reducing what might have become a dangerously universalist impulse, raising standards that could be applied in Palestine or Cameroon to narcissistic solidarity with people like us. Now, if you so much as bring up any parallel between what Russia is doing in Ukraine and what the U.S. and Britain, and actually Ukraine, joined in with the invasion of Iraq and similar enterprises like that, you're immediately denounced as a sympathizer with Putin. What do you make of this impulse to protect against any criticism or any drawing any whataboutist parallels?
This sort of defense is obviously much more rigorous and, let's say, forceful during periods of crisis. You know, it's always there, but it becomes all the more important to police when there's a perception of some kind of mortal danger. And the very fact that Russia is capable of doing this and is a nuclear-armed state and couldn't be stopped without inviting the possibility of nuclear obliteration, which thankfully the Pentagon doesn't seem to want, does raise the cultural stakes, I think, potentially. There is also the sort of wrinkle that we have lived through the last 4 or 5 years in which we've been told that various things which are true are Russian propaganda. To take one example, Hillary Clinton's famous super predators comment, a racist remark about young black men and criminality. Certainly Russian propaganda outlets, cyber war outlets, if you like, utilized this and signal boosted this kind of reality. But if it happens to be possible to say it truthfully, if it happens to be the case, then you can't really blame Russian propaganda for bringing it up. So that there is, for example, a lot of Twitter activity, Instagram activity, and so on by, you know, pro-Putin sources. And they're not all controlled by the long arm of Moscow. That's not the way it works. But, you know, these memes are being put out there which essentially have the effect of relativizing what Putin is doing or minimizing it in relationship to an hysterical Western response by bringing up examples of U.S. crimes. For example, there was a recent story which got about that the Space Center in the United States had stripped honors from Yuri Gagarin in light of the global situation. Now, that is not unlike some things that have happened, but it also wasn't entirely true. You know, what had actually happened was that this space center was going to have a night called Yuri's Night, and they decided to rename it. Now, I think that's dumb. I think that's incredibly stupid, but it's not the same thing as stripping honors. So there's a sense in which Russian propaganda does work, and it does work by, let's say, rendering clearer than true or exaggerating real tendencies in paranoid Western culture. So we have to navigate this terrain rather carefully. You know, so the examples that I raised here, taking supermarkets, taking Russian vodka off the shelves, that's true. And it's crazy. It's in no way helps the people of Ukraine. And it certainly doesn't help the brave anti-war movement in Russia, which is the agency that I think, alongside resisting Ukrainians, that has the potential to cause a crisis in Putin's war. It doesn't help them. The danger is that if we are unaware of what Russian propaganda is doing, then, of course, we can be portrayed in this way. I don't think that I'm prepared to shut up about, you know, the hypocrisy of the West just because it's convenient for Putin, any more than I'm prepared to not criticize what Putin is doing because it happens to be all too convenient for the warmongers in the West. And so there's a need for a political and intellectual independence in this context, more than ever, because of the claustrophobic atmosphere that's being created by the propaganda on both sides.
It's very difficult to think two things at once, though. At the end of the piece, you say that the struggle in it right now is really about the moral rearmament of the West. Could you expand on that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not here talking about the war in Ukraine. That's going on for rather different reasons, but rather the culture war that is taking place, which is almost taking place in lieu of a military intervention. There is a sense that when it was Syria or Libya, it was more credible, more plausible to say, well, Obama should intervene. He should send in ground troops, at least send in a no-fly zone to police the area. Since that's not possible, what we're getting is an attempt to reorganize domestic politics along the lines of a civilizational war with Russia. Now, as usual, when we get this sort of thing, this mirrors the civilizational discourse of Putin and his allies, their hackneyed far-right cleaving Eurasianism. They tend to be in a certain symbiosis. What I think is happening with regard to the journalists who are saying, you're appeasers if you don't want a no-fly zone, we should challenge Vlad, we should sock him on the chin and not take any nonsense from him, all of that sort of stuff. This is really about purging. So in the UK context particularly, I can't speak as clearly about what's happening in the United States, but in the UK context particularly, there's a need on the part of the political centre to purge the spectre of Corbynism, to say never again will we have someone who was anti-NATO, who was against Western foreign policy, who supported the Palestinians, and who would have been even slightly skeptical of some of the claims that were being made about Russia. That's one part of it. There's another part of it, which is about reviving the reputation of Europe as an idea. And, you know, a lot of it is mired in the anti-Brexit campaigning of the hard center, as I like to call them. The people who are fanatical about Brexit, fanatical about the need to remain within the institutions of Europe, and one of the ways in which they have seen fit to do so, since they don't really have much in the way of politics beyond a generic, beyond pensant opposition to the Tory right, is to say that being in Europe is important to our civilizational identity, it's important to our security, and it can enable us to withstand the future offensives of Putin, and so on. So there's an element of that to it as well. Also, we have had a long period in which traditional Atlanticism in British and European politics has been on the wane. It's always in some sort of crisis when there's a right-wing leader in the United States. Trump made it particularly hard for people in British or European politics to be simply pro-American. There was a lot of nostalgia, a sort of post-Washington melancholia in the commentariat when Trump was in power. You know, the Americans don't want to lead anymore was the big fear. And here we've got this chance to revitalize Atlanticism because everybody's talking about NATO now. And NATO suddenly appears to a variety of people and groups who had been skeptical before, for example, the Finnish government, large sectors of Ukrainian people who previously didn't particularly want to join NATO now are looking at it more fondly. This has given a chance to revitalize on an ideological level and on the level of military expenditures this idea of an Atlantic coalition I think that's, for the birds, I think that's fallen apart, in the long run. It wasn't just a temporary crisis with Trump. The United States is entering a period of, or has been entering for a long time, a period of imperial decline. Biden's forced exit from Afghanistan was just the latest punctuating moment in that. But certainly there are a lot of people who are nostalgic for an era when the United States was unparalleled in its global dominance and are fearful of a future in which the United States has any serious rivals or competitors. Ironic that Russia should be the big devil, because, of course, as the American right knows very well, the big challenger is going to be China, which is, very cautiously critical of Putin's war and paying close attention to his military failures, because a lot of the Chinese military has been built around the Russian model, and they may now be panicking about their ability to handle major wars in the future. So there's a lot of things happening here that are not directly about the military struggle and its realities, and not directly about Ukrainian politics and its realities, because there's hardly any discussion of that, but much more about trying to reconsolidate and recompose the kinds of political identities that could support, say, the war in Iraq or Afghanistan, and the idea of a decisive intervention in future conflicts or humanitarian disasters. The idea that the United States and its allies could be the world's foremost moral agents because they happen to be the strongest powers in the world. I think, one last thing on this. I don't know if you've had this in the United States to the same extent, but in the UK, there is among a certain constituency, not a majority, but it's not negligible either, nostalgia for the long 1990s. You know, a real harking back to an era when that particular layer of people felt very hopeful and felt very optimistic, that the world was liberalizing. There were no serious challenges to liberal democracy. Capitalism seemed to be growing, and growing in a way that could potentially be used for benevolent ends, the right was on the back foot for a period of time, although I think that was only superficially the case. We're at a stage where I would say these are morbid symptoms. These are symptoms of the political exhaustion of the traditional governing center, their inability to imagine a future project and to enact it. We've seen that, notwithstanding Biden's, I think, serious efforts to shift the political spectrum on some issues, he has been stalemated. And I think that would be the case for almost any government that attempted to do the same. There's a kind of governing stalemate across the advanced capitalist world, to use a rather antiquated idiom. So these ideological formations are essentially attempts to fill in a gap, the gap of vision, the gap of constructive, pragmatic answers to real problems in the world today.
That was Richard Seymour. You can find his article on the New Left Review's website at newleftreview.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break. Was some of Pavement's Embassy Row, a selection inspired by Richard Seymour's mention of a nostalgia for the 1990s. We're very familiar with attacks on school curricula coming from the right, mainly around race and sex. Less attention is being paid to equally savage attacks on our libraries, where reactionaries want to ban books, and with them, ideas. Here with more is my good friend Emily Drabinsky, Interim Chief Librarian of the Graduate Center Library at the City University of New York. Emily Drabinsky.
The attacks in the curriculum, public school curriculums, are getting a lot of attention, but libraries are suffering similar attacks. Could you describe some of what's going on?
So I'm from Boise, Idaho, and the Idaho legislature this week passed a bill advanced out of the House that would threaten any librarian who distributed pornography to children, defined as materials that you and I would purchase gladly and share with our kids, you know, about being gay and having gay parents and, you know, really benign stuff, would put them in jail for a year and fine them $10,000.
Personally, the librarian would personally be responsible.
The individual librarian. So there are the challenges that we see in the news, but I've been talking to a million librarians and they have real fear that they'll be sued, that they'll be put in jail, that the books will be pulled from the shelves, that they will be held responsible legally and financially for this kind of stuff. So it's, the attacks are insidious, I think, for that reason. They're large scale, like the threat is sort of everywhere. And then it's really real. So imagine you are a librarian working in a public library in Cuna, Idaho, say. And what's your network? Where are your connections? What's the solidarity? How are you going to stand against these incursions? It's sort of impossible to imagine the strength it would take an individual librarian to keep books on the shelf that they could potentially get thrown in jail for. So, yeah, it's brutal.
And I imagine this is happening in other states, too, besides Idaho.
Oh, sure. It's everywhere. Florida, Texas. There was a case in New York State last week where the state librarian of New York posted a photo of herself holding the book Genderqueer on Twitter and had that resulted in her being put on administrative leave. So it's everywhere. It isn't just in sort of this fantasy of this other place. It's all over the country, and it's organized and targeted and scary.
So you mentioned these librarians are pretty much fighting this battle alone. Are there, like, state librarian associations that can offer some sort of support or any kind of, you know, labor organizations? Or
sure. There's definitely, like, organizing around this issue and advocacy work happening. So the Texas Library Association has a hotline that people can call and get help if they are facing a challenge. And the American Library Association has the Office of Intellectual Freedom. You can call them and they will... They have money available to support people who are facing legal challenges. So there are those kinds of organizations, but I think what's missing is the kind of deep organization and deep solidarity across library workers en masse so that people feel supported. Because it's one thing to, like, call a nameless office and get a couple thousand dollars and have them say, here are some other phone numbers you can call. And then there's another way, right, where if library workers across the country were organized densely enough, we could be mobilized quickly to respond to these kinds of challenges where we see them. And there's some of that, like there's some very fierce librarians in Florida that have organized that. But I think for a lot of us, we're sitting here watching our colleagues face these kinds of challenges and like, what are we supposed to do? What can I do? I can't do anything. There's also the sort of like manufacture of total despair. And people have no idea what to do. So I think now is like a moment where if we could give some people things to do, to sort of organize with one another and to build solidarity across library types and across geography, this is a time where if we could hop on it, we could do something meaningful.
I'd imagine some people think of libraries as obsolete, you know, in this age of digital, instant digital information, who needs libraries anymore? So could you give us a rousing defense of the library?
A rousing defense of the library. Talk about a right-wing talking point, right? Like, this is what the right does. They take public institutions, they defund them, they make them difficult and challenging and impossible so that nobody uses them who can afford not to, right? And then the people who can afford not to use them don't use them anymore and will make claims like, this institution is obsolete. I don't use it. It's not worth funding. That's an argument, and we hear it all the time in libraries. But if you work in the library, you know it's not obsolete. It's full of people. The public library, if you ever walk by Brooklyn's, the Central Library in Grand Army Plaza, line out the door, you know, or line at the door, like, waiting for it to open because people are, like, really totally want to be in there. They want to be in there for their kids. They want to be in their used bathroom. They want to be in there to plug in their laptop and do some typing. They want to get a cup of coffee. They want to read books. They want to sit inside of a well-lit, heated place in the winter or cooled in the summer. The library is not obsolete to the people who use it. And anyone who goes into a library can tell you that. So, like, the pandemic hits. I'm working in the library. Guess what I heard constantly, a constant pressure for a year and a half until we were able to open our doors. When are you going to be open? I need to use the library. I need to come in. I need to come in. So I didn't spend a year and a half, like, batting away those demands for no reason. It's because people really need to use the library. So they're not obsolete. And the only people who think they're obsolete are the people who want to defund libraries, schools, parks, hospitals, roads, everything that we value as public institutions and public infrastructure.
What about the challenges of running a library during COVID? I mean, people must be afraid to come in. Staff must be afraid to come in. What's it been like?
Yeah, it's been totally. It's like, what? I need to come into the library. I'm afraid to come into the library. It's challenging. So we pivoted immediately to offering a ton of digital services. My library, we offered online workshops, and we bought a bunch of electronic books, and we could connect you to electronic resources and do sort of all the things that people imagine make the library obsolete, right? That's access to this digital world of information. So we did all that, you know, we paid extra for it, and it was meaningful. But again, nobody, like, called me constantly on the phone begging for a big data set. People called me on the phone wanting to come into the library. So I think what I learned from the pandemic is that the space of the library is really crucial. And so during the pandemic, it's not safe to come inside, right? We can't be together in enclosed spaces. And I thought it would be clearer, and I think probably a lot of us did. We thought we would, like, the vaccine would come out, and then we would come out of our homes and rip off the masks, and that hasn't been true at all. It's been these sort of partial half steps, and you can come in, but you have to keep your mask on, and you have to stay 6 feet away. And then it was like, you can come in, you have to keep your mask off, but on, but you can be closer to each other. Now we have this new directive from the state and from CUNY that we can come in and we don't need to wear our masks. And, you know, I'm wondering what it will take for the norms to shift. And, you know, it's an existential problem for libraries, too. It's year-end budget close, and I'm up to my ears with trying to, like, defend the need to resource the library. But if people don't come in, it's harder and harder to make that claim. So I need to figure out how to get people back in the library. And the ways that we would normally do that, we're going to have wine and cheese, it's going to be fun, there's going to be an exhibit or a show, and we can't do those things yet, and people are anxious about doing those things. It's an anxious space right now, I would say.
Now, I imagine the public libraries around the country are under serious funding pressure, too.
Oh, yeah, totally.
You know, what's that look like?
Well, it's like every other public institution in the country. We don't need it. It's not necessary. We can privatize it. We can make a corporate partnership, lots of that kind of talk, and it means that the library doesn't have the funds to. I think mostly it's physical plant. The fact that the state no longer invests in public buildings in any significant way. And so the library is, above all things, I think, what I think now, sitting here talking to you, post-pandemic, the library is a space. It's a space where people can leave their homes and go inside somewhere else. It's a non-commercial space. You don't have to buy anything. And you ideally won't be sold anything, right? Like, it is just a space to come in and be together.
Everything you just said runs against the ethos of our time. So.
It absolutely runs against the ethos of our times, which is why the library is so important, especially in this critical moment, right? We all saw, like, everything kind of fall apart with COVID. And what we really saw fall apart was, like, any mechanism for us to get together in person. For those of us who sort of observed masking requirements and distancing and took the pandemic really seriously, we didn't get together. We didn't see each other. You know, the right got together, right? Like, we have been sort of on the left, I think, by and large, being responsible citizens and not trying not to infect each other and trying to keep mass death to be a little less mass. But the right has been getting together, and they've been planning. You know, none of the attacks on public library collections are singular. They all come with the same exact template. People are challenging the same exact books. They have scripts. They've learned how to do it. They've been at conventions.
Is this the religious right or the Koch right or who's behind it?
I don't know. I'd have to look it up, and I'm really busy, but it's something. You know, I'm not sure who's funding it, but there are many stories about, like, going to some sort of right-wing event, and then there's a table, you know, which is exactly what we need to be doing, hand-to-hand, talking to people about how to challenge a book.
Now, I've always thought of librarians and libraries in general as paragons of free expression.
Yes.
The whole bedrock principle is we have an inventory of books that people can read.
Come in, read.
We don't care what the content is. Yeah. It's up to them. It's
totally.
Between you and your book and your conscience.
Don't care.
Yeah. That really seems to be under fundamental challenge now.
Absolutely. And it's weird, right? Because the right is, it's like they want the sort of freedom, you know, and the sort of vision of independent, individual, everything, but they want to also control what all of our children are reading. But it's not about that, right? Like, it's not about the books for them. Like, challenge the books as a way of weakening the institution and making it not good, right? And if, as long as it's bad, then people stop going there and we won't need it anymore and we can use those funds to do something else.
Tax cuts for rich people.
Exactly. Like, what worries me is the way that the right is using these book challenges as a way not only to challenge books, but also to give people a feeling of power. They're producing for people opportunities to feel that feeling you get when you can control something in the world. When you can look at the world and be like, oh, I want to change it. And they're giving you like a little template and you can change it. You can get a book removed from the shelf, right? And we're not doing that in the same way. And so I'm quite worried because when you feel that, you want to feel it again and feel more of it. So I see libraries as the terrain of struggle, but also the terrain of sort of power consolidation on the right. I find it quite frightening.
Yeah, I was just going to say that it seems that the right takes this sort of thing very seriously. Public schools, curriculums, and libraries. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't seem that there's any countervailing organization or seriousness coming from the left. Is that a fair perception?
Well, I certainly feel it about libraries, right? That people look at the library and it's like a space of nostalgia, of like prior to Google, we would go to the library with my mom and pick out some books and bring them. People treat it as a sort of fable or a story when really it's a public institution that is about purchasing things in common and sharing them in a community. It's like amazing, you know, you kind of can't believe it still exists, which is why I fear that it is not long for this world.
What can people do? People who listen to this radio show.
Go to the library. Go to the library. First thing, go to the library. Go use it. Go check it out. Go check out a book, you know, use it. Go in and see what's happening there. So that's number one. I mean, I think you've got to fold libraries into the any political project you're doing, right? So we've got fights for a Green New Deal, right? And so that Green New Deal has to also be explicitly a Green New Deal for libraries, because libraries are the spaces where we preserve history.
Many of them grand old public buildings.
Grand old public buildings subject to fire and flood and all those things. And so when we talk about the Green New Deal, it has to include libraries. When we talk about funding for public institutions, it can't just be schools. It has to be libraries. That is part of it, too. For me, when I think about sort of working on behalf of libraries, I want... So when librarians talk about this, they're like, I want funding for the library. And I think they make fewer connections between the library and other public and social infrastructures. So libraries are also, because they're the last, sort of the last funded public good, public institution, that's where you pick up your tax forms. It's where you sign up for the ACA. You sign up for COVID tests. That's where you pick up your vaccine and your everything, right? It becomes the like last point of distribution.
Kind of like the post office.
You've got the post office and you've got the library. That's it. So librarians need to see that in order for us to get back to what we do, which is books and reading and information, we need other public institutions to be equally well-funded. So tying the fight for library funding to the fight for public funding in general, and I would like the left to think about libraries when they're thinking about enlarging the pie and who that pie is for.
That was Emily Drabinsky, Interim Chief Librarian at the CUNY Grad Center. The Cultural Cold War, the struggle against communism waged by the U.S. ideological state apparatus in the artistic and intellectual sphere, is a long-standing obsession of Behind the News. In the latest iteration of that obsession, here's an interview with Annie Levin, author of Politics and the MFA, in the current issue of Current Affairs magazine. She is a writer who did her own journey through a Master of Fine Arts program some years ago, who now reports on arts and labor for Observer.com. Annie Levin.
You're writing about creative writing programs, but you did one. When and where, and was it on the model of the Iowa program that you write about?
I went to Hunter College 2006-2008 for my MFA, And I think it was partially on the model that I talk about. Like in the 90s and the early 2000s, there was a something of a turn away from the kind of like Cold War modernism formalism that I write about in my current affairs article. And I think some of my teachers were taking that in. They were sort of more interested in postmodern forms. And I think you can make the argument that the postmodern fiction and modern fiction are both apolitical in some senses, but there was more of a turn towards looking outwards and looking into you know, capturing voices other than your own when I was getting my MFA.
Okay, so let's go into the history of this Iowa program. It is the most famous I guess, distinguished or reputable program right. in the country. What's the history of it? When was it founded? By whom? And what were its purposes?
The Iowa program was founded in 1936, and during the Cold War, it was run by this poet named Paul Engel, who was the department head for many, many years over there. And he gets described in Eric Bennett's book, Workshops of Empire, as a cold warrior, because he thought of Iowa as the equivalent of like an academy of writers for Americans. Like the Soviets were training artists in communist propaganda, in socialist realism, and so America had to do its part in propagandizing for the other side, for liberal capitalism.
Capitalist realism in counterweight to
yeah.
the socialist.
Capitalist realism.
And what did that mean in terms of form and content?
Well, I think there was a general push towards very specific kind of writing that was focuses on the surfaces of things. It focuses on the mundane, the day-to-day, the life of somebody living, you know, atomized nuclear family in the suburbs. You know, something that is that does not touch upon ideology, that focuses on individual people who are responsible for everything that happens to them.
To call itself not ideological or not political, of course, is ideological and political. So what was the underlying political content of this allegedly non-political approach to writing?
Well, I think it was to get people to forget about politics, to get people to forget about the outside world, and to focus on self-improvement, I think was a big part of modernist literature. Self-improvement, the things that happen to you, the bad things that happen to you, they're your fault. And so I think that's a writer like a conservative Catholic writer like Flannery O'Connor, who's very popular, came out of the Iowa program, is very popular and in mid-century, and I think has remained pretty well-read for you know, since her heyday. She is obsessed with the scouring of atomized souls, of just looking into people's hearts and seeing all darkness and sin.
But, you know, I would think Catholicism is not exactly ideologically neutral. And how does she reconcile the Catholicism with this very desert dry form?
She reconciled it by being a genius. She is applying her faith to a very, very narrow manner of writing where you follow somebody through their day, through their mistakes. And I think she was very ideologically driven and politically conservative and very invested in the idea that, you know, not all the world's problems can be solved through social programs, through the welfare state. And that was like a point that she I think made in interviews while she was writing. And I think that gets conveyed in a lot of her short fiction, just how problematic people can be. You are dark, you are sinful. The things that happen to you are your fault. Don't go blaming other people.
You mentioned The New Yorker, serious post-war fiction. It was all about sad white people with relationship problems. Is that the kind of writing that people learn to do coming out of Iowa?
I think it's not just the kind of writing people learn how to do coming out of Iowa, you know, back in the 50s. It's what the kind of writing people are still trying to do. And I think we are among creative writers, everyone likes to complain about the MFA story or the New Yorker story as just kind of being autobiographical about the lives of writers, of academics, of upper middle class people living very comfortable lives, you know, in proximity to, say, you know, the kind of people who work in the publishing industry. And that's the kind of work that came out of this period. And I think it was in part a political project as well as, you know, having, we see it as being part and parcel of, the culture of the Cold War, the zeitgeist of the time. And I'm trying to make the point in my current affairs article that this was a conscientious project that, you know, some government money was put into to get the culture to move in a certain direction.
Yeah, I mean, this is very much fits into the story of the Cultural Cold War with the CIA and its allied and often front foundations throwing money at this sort of thing.
Exactly.
You could cite this directive, which is often said about journalism as well as creative writing, show, don't tell. What's that mean? What are the limitations of it?
Show, don't tell is your basic writing workshop advice. Like, you get it from every fiction workshop instructor will tell you to show, don't tell. You know, show your characters acting. If you're going to describe something, give your telling details with your character actually doing something, moving, having the action move forward with everything that you're writing. Don't go on endlessly about your character's backstory and their ancestors, and don't describe their shoelace collection in their basement unless it's, you know, particularly important to the plot. And I think that's that is generally good advice, especially for young students. I think where it gets tricky is if you kind of broaden that out to all of world literature, where you see that there are very, very few writers who take that dictum as like always applicable. So I talk about how showing and not telling, when applied to world literature, just doesn't make a whole lot of sense, where, you know, sometimes you actually have to do a lot of telling in order to get your point across. And telling in the context that we've been talking about means getting your ideology across, getting your political point across, instead of just showing how your character, you know, spends their days, focusing on, you know, exactly how they make their coffee in the morning. You might talk about what the social, political, cultural context in which they're living, which might come across as telling.
Yeah, but then, you know, as you point out, many very canonical and admired writers like Melville don't fit this bill. There's a long chapter on whaling that's legendary for anybody who tries to get through Moby Dick. But then you also quote this masterful little sketch by Jane Austen, which gets down to the character's income. These all violate the show-don't-tell rule, don't they?
Yeah. So I think, yeah, the whale taxonomy chapter in Moby Dick is a wonderful case in point, where it's just lists of whale parts of whales and different types of whales. And for some people, it's their favorite chapter in Moby Dick. And it's sort of like tortured and weird and a little cringy, but at the same time, you know, wonderfully unique. Moby Dick would not be the same novel without the whale taxonomy chapter. And in the passage that I quote is from Pride and Prejudice, the passage in which Mr. Darcy, the love interest, is introduced. We get in just a very, very few amount of words how Mr. Darcy is, what he looks like, how much money he has, and also what if impact he has walking into a room full of strangers over the course of an entire evening. And it's this masterfully compact paragraph that does it, it's like a little computer program. It does so many things in very, very few words that you wouldn't really be able to get if you were writing like a modern novel in which everything was shown.
Yeah, the novels of, you know, the 18th, 19th century are very much almost like works of sociology in parts. You know, they're marriage, class structure, changing class structures. Yeah, it doesn't fit these prescriptions at all.
Yeah. And I think that the Cold War writing, where you're giving, you know, beautifully rendered descriptions of the mundane, has produced an incredible literature. At the same time, there's so much that has been lost as we focus on depictions of the mundane, on soul-scouring Flannery O'Connor-style writing. And I think a lot of that is 18th, 19th century writing, the novels that could do everything that could be social satire, that could be political critique, that showed huge numbers of people going through these massive changes during the early Industrial Revolution.
But now, how is this school of writing faring now that white guys are very much out of fashion?
I think that it is faring about as well as literary publishing is faring, which is to say not great. But I don't think really that there has been another style of writing that has come to take its place that is as widespread.
Well, we're having autofiction and memoir are rather popular.
Yeah. Yeah. I think autofiction and memoir, I think that's an improvement upon sort of Cold War formalism. But I think a lot of it is still very much in this same vein. We're still talking about, you know, going very deeply into one perspective. And I think what's changed in, you know, literature in the last 20 years is that that perspective has changed. We are no longer just talking about white men.
But the big complex social novel is still out of fashion.
I think so. I think the big complex social novel is still out of fashion. I think that somebody like Jonathan Franzen tries to nudge the novel in that direction when he, you know, every 5 years or so when he comes out with his next big novel. I think he is interested in writing about the broader culture in this way. And I think that is also what gets him into a lot of trouble with his, you know, online critics, is that he does have very harsh things to say about the culture, and he does make social criticism, and he's, you know, his politics aren't always wonderful. So I think people are also very frightened of giving their political point of view in literary culture, literary fiction.
In the age of the tweet.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you. That was Anne Levin, author of Politics in the MFA and the current issue of Current Affairs magazine. It's not on the web, alas, just in the print magazine. For more, see currentaffairs.org. In that article, Levin mentions affinities between that style of writing and the New Criticism, a style of literary criticism popular during the mid-20th century that focused on close readings of texts themselves rather than on their historical or cultural settings. When I was in college, I took a couple of courses, one on modern poetry and one on William Faulkner, with one of the leading New Critics, Cleanth Brooks. Brooks, who grew up in Kentucky and had a deep affinity with Southern literature, interrupted one of his lectures on Faulkner to praise the Confederacy as an alternative to the brutalities of Yankee capitalism. It was a nice revelation of the politics underlying his intense formalism. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, speaking of the persistence of high modernism, Lana Del Rey doing a bit of T.S. Eliot's poem, Burnt Norton. Till next week, bye.
Time present and time past are both perhaps present in time future. And time future contained in time past. If all time is eternally present, all time is unredeemable. What might have been is an abstraction, remaining a perpetual possibility, only in a world of speculation. What might have been and what has been point to one end, which is always present. Footfalls echo in the memory, down the passage, which we did not take, towards the door we never